pave the way forward. Nurture a positive way of thinking. Positivity is not something you're born with. It's something you need to consciously acquire. Practicing gratitude and adopting a growth mindset is a sure way of becoming more positive, but you can always do more. Focus on your ideal self. Perhaps you're stuck right now, but what would your ideal self do in this situation? Can you remember the last time when you were the best possible version of yourself? What's the difference between that you and this you? Is there something you can retrieve from that experience and use now to inspire yourself to move forward? Challenges and obstacles are a normal part of our lives, and we should embrace them as valuable lessons and learning resources. Yet, we often forget to do this and end up being all stressed out and unsatisfied with life. That's why I'm here to remind you that in every yin, there's a yang, and vice versa. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, take the time to seek a new perspective. Whether changing your vantage point or opening your mind to new ideas, you can shrink your challenges when you gain a new outlook. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Greg Palast returns with our weekly edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin. Today, the Supremes say right-wing ass-kisser Senator Lindsey Graham must testify before a Georgia grand jury investigating Trump's election meddling and the attempted fix of the 2020 election. Also, is Bibi Netanyahu back for another stint as PM of Israel? Criminal indictments and all, we'll investigate with reporter Richard Silverstein. And we rebroadcast a very powerful interview with Kevin Pina on Haiti. Very moving, so we're going to put that back on today as well. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are live for you today in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And it is once again time for our weekly Election Crimes Bulletin.
This whole election is being rigged. The election is being rigged.
It's totally rigged.
Yes, Donald, it's rigged because your cronies rigged it.
So says Rolling Stone investigative reporter Greg Palast.
You're removing black voters from the voter rolls just so you can win this election?
We will treat those people from January 6th fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons.
So you didn't call him, but you challenged his right to vote or have his ballot challenged.
Sir, get out of my house.
Okay, I will get out of your house.
House.
I just...
Now.
It's now time for your Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Palast.
And I'm Dennis Bernstein. We are happy to welcome back Greg Palast. Very special couple of weeks. His film, Vigilante Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman, is now making the rounds, and there's going to be a special showing. We're going to tell you about that in a little bit. But we, Greg Palast, have got some news. Lindsey Graham got some bad news, and so did Mark Meadows. Lindsey from the Supremes, Meadow from the Appeals Court. What's going on there?
Actually, a very interesting linked rulings. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is going to be forced to testify before the grand jury in Atlanta. Maybe I'll meet him down there. I'm going Thursday. He has used the idea that the Constitution has something called the speech or debate clause. What that says is that you can't haul a congressman or a senator into court to question them or harass them or charge them with a crime because of something that they said on the floor of Congress. That's really important. We don't want senators going, ending up getting arrested by in a state where that didn't agree with them. That's the purpose of it. But the Constitution does not do, Lindsey, is give you some type of Harry Potter invisibility cloak that says you can do whatever you want because you're a senator. You can be a witness to a felony crime and not have to testify about it. That ain't nowhere in the Constitution. And even our right-wing Supreme Court kind of scratched its head and said, huh? When Lindsey Graham brought up this argument. So even our Supreme Court said, Lindsey, you're going to have to testify. And let's remember what this is about. He's going to have to testify about conversations he had with the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, who's running for re-election, the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who's running for re-election. And I'd like to know, and I think the people of Georgia need to know, if there was a conspiracy with these officials in Georgia to figure out how to overturn the election. Now, we all know that they didn't do it. Biden is president, and he got the electoral votes in Georgia. But so far, all we've had is a lot of blather that's not under oath from the governor and the Secretary of State and Lindsey Graham. It's a very different thing, Dennis, when you're facing perjury, when you're asked about what Trump said to you and what you did in these secret calls. How come they're fighting so hard when all they are is witnesses? It's like if you see a hold up on the street and the cop says, what did you see? You don't say, well, you're going to have to get a subpoena and go to the Supreme Court to get that out of me, buddy. Usually people that say that are involved in the crime. Not that I want to speculate too much. Mark Meadows had the same issue. Now, Meadows, interestingly, was told that the speech and debate clause requires him to testify. How did this happen? The same clause of the Constitution. He challenged the right of the January 6th committee to get his text messages on the January 6th, on the day of the January 6th riot and before then and after then. He's claiming that he's claiming executive privilege, but he's attacking the U.S. Senate for holding investigative hearings on what was an attempted overthrow of our government. And the courts are saying, no, you can't, that you are in effect dragging U.S. senators and congressmen who are on the January 6th committee into court to say, you can't say what you're saying. Well, that is protected by the Constitution. He's trying to impede the constitutional requirements, the constitutional work of the Senate and Congress. And sorry, Mark Meadows, no, you don't get a free pass just because you're working for Agent Orange. That doesn't, we do not have a secret government.
And Mark Meadows is the key, because he's the chief of staff. He is the one that we already heard testimony about, that he was conscious, aware of what Trump's state of mind was, and he was willing to go forward, to be silent, if you will. That's certainly an action in this context, while Trump right. was willing to allow his vice president essentially to be executed.
Well, in fact, if you see in the film, you get that famous chant. We have them on screen chanting, hang Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence. And apparently his boss, the president, apparently said something along the lines of, oh, he deserves it. But we need to get that under oath from Mr. Meadows, who's chief of staff. Now, Mark Meadows is an extreme right-wing congressman. He was getting deluged with calls and messages from Ivanka Trump, from Jared Kushner, and from others saying, begging Mark Meadows to go in and tell the president, call off the killers, call off the insurrections, call off the madmen. People are going to die, in fact, and people did die. They didn't hang Mike Pence, but cops died. protesters died. This is no joke. This is a murder scene. And Lindsey Graham and Mark Meadows are playing games with testifying about a murder. Okay, we can talk about the politics, but this is a murder scene, and they're trying to get out of it. But, and that's
and
where
we should say that Pence happens to be in Georgia today campaigning for the gov. So he has chosen very carefully, while he's been silent about a great deal. He certainly has a contribution if we wanted to understand
and
the
And once again,
puzzle. Go on. Yeah.
Brian Kemp was able to convince and got even Williams, the prosecutor, to hold off on his having to testify about this crime until after the election next Tuesday, which to me is a bit nuts, because I think we really, in an open government, we kind of need to know what the president and the governor of Georgia were saying to each other before you decide whether to vote for this guy or not. I think that should be public before the election, not after. But there's plenty about Kemp, and I know that many of you missed my film in San Francisco at the Grand Lake. We had a big crowd for this COVID period, and of course we're completely slammed out, packed out, sold out in Los Angeles for the KPFK folks and those. I promised you a celebrity, and sure enough, Jamie Foxx led the panel discussion with Black Voters Matter and the ACLU. But since there's no room in Los Angeles, we're not going back to San Francisco. We are having, specially, Jamie Foxx is helping fund this, a national free broadcast of Vigilante, Georgia's vote suppression hitman, because Black Voters Matter and Jesse Jackson said this is a national film. This ain't a Georgia film. We want it out nationally. So for the next 3 days only, that's it. You can go to vigilantemovie.com, vigilantemovie.com, and you can watch the film gratis. And I'm just telling you guys now on Pacifica, sorry you missed L.A., was slammed out. Sorry you missed Oakland, but this is your chance. Vigilantemovie.com.
All right, we just have a minute left. There's a lot on the show today. So you're also working on a piece now, an article in Black Gwinnett. That's, the Georgia magazine.
Georgia, right.
So that's out now.
Black Gwinnett magazine. It's very simple. The thing is, it's from the film. A piece of the film just goes into Brian Kemp's family history. Before they were Kemp, they were called Habersham and Roswell. These were the people, it was Kemp's family that forced slavery on Georgia. Georgia had outlawed slavery, believe it or not, before the Revolutionary War.
Kemp's family.
And they ended up imposing, Kemp's family ended up imposing slavery on Georgia, bringing in
how do people get this? How can they check it out? Greg,
and they watch the movie, which has that story, vigilantemovie.com.
Yes,
and the important thing here is that Brian Kemp just signed law SB 1185, which says that you can't teach divisive history in a Georgia school or college. Basically, he's saying you will lose your job as a teacher if you tell people that my family brought slavery to Georgia. That you can't. You can't divide, suppress, as one of our people in the film says, you can't divide suppressing history from suppressing the vote.
No, you can't. All right, that's Greg Palast. We do the Election Crimes Bulletin every week. He's got the film Vigilante. You can check it out tomorrow for free. I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to go right now our excerpt from yesterday's show, very moving interview we did on Haiti with Kevin Pina. Let's jump right there now. We are not happy to see what's been going on in Haiti. We've been watching it going on, Kevin Pina, for about three decades or longer now. But whenever we think it can't get worse, it does get worse. And we're seeing not just one journalist being killed, but journalism is essentially, any attempt at it is under attack. You yourself were death squatted when you tried to report for this show.
Couple times.
Couple of times.
Once arrested, Once arrested and beaten and thrown into a jail, and coincidentally, that's a Delma 33, Comisariat, which is the police station in Delma 33. Delma, of course, is a commune in the West. It's called an extension of Port-au-Prince. It leads to, it's on the road to the airport, to Saint-Louverture International Airport. But it's always had a reputation for brutality. And yesterday, on Sunday, there had been one journalist who had been arrested. And then another group of journalists joined a demonstration to try to get him released. And then a second journalist was shot and killed, according to eyewitnesses, was shot with live ammunition by the Haitian police. I circulated the video. I, of course, tried to sanitize it best I could, given the content, but circulated the video on social media beginning last night, right after it had begun, and talked to a couple of the eyewitnesses who were there on the ground. And interestingly enough, I then got attacked by people who were following the Miami Herald, which said that, in fact, he had been killed by an errant tear gas canister. And this was despite the eyewitness testimony of people who were there on the ground. And it's interesting, the battle over social media, of course, is that there are people who are just now disrupting, right? They don't want the truth to come out. And, of course, it's not good for the Haitian police's image, because it's not good for U.S. foreign policy, which is now supporting the police. This is a U.S.-trained, a U.S.-armed police force. And, of course, it's embarrassing when they pull out live ammunition and they gun down journalists at a protest.
And this prison and what happened here is, this is the scene of many such incidences, deadly incidences, where U.S.-supported, trained cops, police, soldiers, death squads, essentially will not tolerate any resistance to sort of the failed state that the United States created. I mean, that's where we are now. Go on, Kevin.
Well, there have been seven journalists in the last 2 months who have been targeted by attack by either gangs. Some burned to death and their bodies burned in Cité Soleil, and others by the police themselves. It's open season on anyone who's trying to report on this nightmare that Haiti has become. And of course, you're absolutely right. You can draw a straight line from what's happening today all the way to the 2004 coup that ousted the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, really destroyed Haiti's democratic institutions. And then, of course, that was followed by the MIF, which was the military, the intervening force that was comprised of Canadian Special Forces, U.S. Special Forces, and French Foreign Legion, which took over the capital after they'd kidnapped Aristide and sent him unceremoniously into exile. And then, to put a legal veneer on it, in June of 2004 was when the United Nations Security Council approved what's called a Chapter 7 intervention, which is not just to oversee negotiations between parties who are in conflict, but to actually intervene with force militarily. This led, of course, to a 13-year United Nations military occupation led by the Army of Brazil under Lula. Lula was just reelected president of Brazil. And the armies of Chile and Argentina on the ground. That 13-year period was marked by massacres, was marked by rape, was marked by torture, was marked by cholera. But more importantly, the United States and Canada in particular said that after destroying Haiti's democratic institutions in 2004 in that coup, that they were then going to pump billions of dollars, and they did, about 15 to 20 billion, the exact figure isn't out there, but at least $20 billion into Haiti to rebuild Haiti's democratic institutions, to put money into the police, to reform them, to put money into the judiciary, to put money into the prison system, all three of which today, despite them controlling the country completely for 13 years and over $20 billion, all of those today do not function. The police are not functional. They're corrupt. The judiciary is not functional. It is corrupt. In the prison system, prisoners are dying of starvation and dying of disease, with the majority of them never having seen a judge and the majority never actually officially being charged with a crime. So this condition, this awful condition today, is a direct result of failed U.S. foreign policy, which led that coup, which was responsible, the Bush administration, leading the international community in a regime change in 2004. We can draw a straight line from that to the situation today, Dennis.
Wow. People don't know the half of it, Kevin. We, thanks to you, have been reporting on this year after year. Now, I just want to go over a few things because people, most people, they try and follow. Even the ones that really want to know what's going on, it's hard to follow the details. But just to say a little bit more, you talked about the United Nations forces coming in. You mentioned cholera. It was, in fact, tracked to the United Nations forces. They're the ones that brought cholera to the Haitians in the middle of all the other suffering. Would that be an overstatement?
Not at all. We know that they tried to cover it up, but when a serious test and investigation occurred, primarily by a Swedish biologist, it was found conclusively that it was the Nepalese United Nations soldiers who had released cholera, brought it from their country into Haiti. It led to over 10,000 deaths. Today we see it resurfacing in the country as conditions worsen. And then, of course, the worst thing is they tried to cover it up. This is Juan Gabriel Valdez, who was part of Unidad Popular in Chile, who's betrayed the entire history of Allende. By now, he was rewarded for his role as the head of the political mission under MINUSTAH, which was the United Nations mission that was the longest period that it was responsible for control, 100% control of Haiti. Juan Gabriel Valdez was rewarded for his despicable role. But he's now the Chilean ambassador to the United States. He lives in Washington, D.C., in a very wealthy lifestyle. We saw that Augusto Helena Rivera, who was the head of the Brazilian military, of course, became the head of internal security, the minister of the internal security under Bolsonaro. He was the one that they were afraid was going to perform the coup against Lula, even though it was Lula who had appointed this authoritarian, this man who was responsible for massacres in Cité Soleil, who was responsible for massacres in Bel Air. It was Lula who directly appointed Augusto Helena Rivera as the head of the Brazilian forces, which were in charge of the United Nations military mission in Haiti. It's an interesting confluence of history that's now, we're able to look at, those of us who know, those details, those amazing details by virtue of hindsight.
Would it be proper to say that essentially the United Nations were the shock troops for U.S., Canadian, French policy in Haiti? I mean, I do remember you being on the ground reporting for us live when you're having to look down the barrel of a UN rifle, and in the context of, at the time, you also ending up on these, I guess, para-government death squads who were calling for your demise.
Well, it's interesting because, I come to find out that, there were many members of police forces and U.S. Marshals and Secret Service who were also working in special investigative units, some of them who founded special investigative units of the United Nations, who gave up in disgust, who were unable to do their jobs, who were trying, some of them were really sincere individuals. So the U.S. was in there. It's just that they couldn't count on many of the people that they put in positions of authority within the UN, because once they discovered the truth and the United Nations tried to cover it up again under Juan Gabriel Valdez, administration for the United Nations, they gave up in disgust, although some of them did keep trying. One of them uncovered the truth behind the assassination of Jean-Marie Vincent, who was one of my mentors in Haiti, who was a peasant leader in Haiti, who was assassinated in August of 1994. The only problem was the person who he found evidence on was protected by the Central Intelligence Agency in the U.S. Embassy. I'm talking about Latortour, Yuri Latortour, who was the nephew of Gerard Latortour, who was of course, the prime minister after the 2004 coup, who was parachuted in from Boca Raton, Florida, to take over. Ariel Henry himself today, the unpopular prime minister that the U.S. is backing, despite the overwhelming majority of Haitians wanting him gone, was one of the members of the so-called Conseil des Sages, the Council of the Wise. After they overthrew Aristide, the United States, because they couldn't follow Haiti's constitution, because it was illegal, it was an illegal coup, they created what was called the Council of the Wise, which is supposed to be this representative body of Haitians from different sectors of society who legitimized the coup. The United States orchestrated giving it a veneer of legitimacy. Ariel Henry, who's the unpopular prime minister that the U.S. refuses to quit backing, was a member of that Conseil des Sages, the Council of the Wise. And that's why I say there's this confluence of history that's astounding that's occurring in Haiti today. And I have to say that if you hear about the possibility of intervention, foreign intervention, it's only because they want to forestall the people's movement, which has had such success in the streets over the last year and a half. Well, before Jovenel Moïse, since Martelly's election, fraudulent election, since Jovenel Moïse's fraudulent elections, people have been protesting nearly regularly for years. Imagine, Martelly was elected in, what, 2011? What, that's 12 years of protest? 10, 11 years of protest? It's extraordinary. And if you're going to hear about intervention, it's because of the success of that movement and it's their inability to divide it and to make it go away. So as the U.S.-backed government of Ariel Henry is challenged more and more in the streets, and the people are beginning to tilt the balance of power in the favor of real change in Haiti, that's when you hear the argument for U.S. intervention the strongest, the argument for foreign intervention, foreign boots on the ground, the loudest in Haiti.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with our senior producer, Kevin Pena, who is an expert and a master on the history and the U.S. subversion of the Haitian movement for self-determination. You've been on this a long time, Kevin. We've been working on it together for quite some time. And it does continually get worse. You talk about protests going on for 10 years because it is a fact, Kevin. I think this is what keeps you going and it keeps
Well, longer,
going.
Right? Because you were hearing some of those reports of protests in, right in 2003, 2004, and all those years after the coup. Remember, we were reporting on
it. Absolutely. And we were documenting massive. Yes, and documenting massive human rights violations by U.S. forces. And this it is an amazing place because despite the profound suffering, again, this is, I think, why this is my point, is the reason we are still with it, because if you feel it any the way I do, Kevin, the Haitian people have a quest, a determination, a desire for self-determination that the largest country in the world could not crush. Largest country, you talk about David and Goliath, they can't kill the spirit. It doesn't mean that they can't continually create expansive amounts of suffering, and that's where
but
we
why?
Are
you know,
now.
We have to also understand why, Dennis. Because
why?
Despite them naming and calling Haiti one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere in the world, the truth is that Haiti has a tremendous amount of mineral wealth. You know, I couldn't believe it when I read the Livre Blanche d'Angelo Main, the Livre Blanche of Family Lavalas, which was Aristide and his political party released after his election in 2000. And it showed that Haiti is full of mineral wealth. You know, there's hundreds of tons of iridium, you know, under Haitian soil. If you know the price of a ton of iridium, you know that Haiti is a very wealthy country. There's uranium, there's gold. There are many other precious minerals and metals that are under Haiti's ground, which is why, you know, this is one of the main reasons why they want to keep Haiti destabilized. It just got out of their control. They could control it when they had the regime of the PHTK, the ruling party of Michel Martelly, for two administrations until, of course, Jovenel Moïse's assassination. Then they lost control of the gangs they ran in order that they used against the opposition, that they used campaigns of terror for to keep people off the streets. They lost control of those gangs that they used against their political opposition. They lost control of a good part of their own political apparatus. And this entire machine that the United States built began to implode upon itself. But then there's also some very strange parts to this, Dennis. For example, how do you then explain that the three main suspects in the assassination of Jovenel Moise are now in U.S. custody in U.S. prisons? How do you explain that the three agencies, the CIA, the FBI, and the DEA, are all requesting that their testimony and the details of the case be redacted, be kept from the public? It's a very odd situation, especially when you understand that those three people who were central that they're accusing, that they're now in U.S. custody, all three of them did have relationships with those three with those three agencies. There are some very strange goings on that the United States government and particularly the intelligence community need to answer for in Haiti, and they do not. Unfortunately, they've been able to operate with impunity for decades, and we are now seeing the result of that, that interference inside of Haiti's internal political affairs, the lack of respect for Haitian sovereignty, the manipulation of its internal politics to create the mess that they've created today. And now, of course, Haitians are saying no. They want to take charge. And there are really responsible, intelligent Haitians. But unfortunately, it's a very difficult, complex situation. But I have ultimate faith that they will work it out if there is not a foreign intervention to preclude their ability to lead themselves. And if the United States and the world stay out of their affairs, they will make this work. But of course, it's not going to be pretty, because part of what the United States has popped up is an apartheid system, a system between the few wealthy families in the oligarchy who they've trusted more than the majority of the people, and the majority of the people who still remain very poor despite Haiti's riches.
And with the help and interceding of key liberal politicians in the United States, would you just briefly remind people, I want to talk about two more things before we let you go, Kev. Would you remind people the role that the Clintons played in bringing Haitians to the current moment of suffering?
Well, probably the thing that, you know, comes to mind first is Hillary Rodham Clinton, then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, intervening in the 2010 elections so that Michel Martelly would be able to win the second round, placing him as the second place winner by literally changing the way the ballots were counted. She used the cover of the Organization of American States. They used the press. You know, they have their mouthpieces in the international press, and that includes the European Union, European press, that includes the U.S. press, the Canadian press, and they were able to manipulate Martelly into that office. Of course, then the Clinton Foundation played a leading role after the 2010 earthquake when there's $7 billion that went up into smoke. They raised, you know, private aid agencies, and that's a conservative estimate, $7 billion to ostensibly change Haiti to build back better. Recognize that campaign? That was the campaign of the Clinton administration, build back better. The same slogan that Biden is using for this country today in his, you know, the trillion-dollar infrastructure project. Well, unfortunately, the trillion-dollar infrastructure project here is anything like the Build Back Better in Haiti. We're going to have a lot of problems in this country, because actually there's nothing discernible to show for it that helped the Haitian people, that improved their lives, that we can say was lasting in any way, shape, or form. And a lot of people ask, where did that money go? And it was really the Clinton Foundation that oversaw, that set the tone for the relief agencies and the non-governmental organizations on the ground to assist Haitians. And that money just disappeared, Dennis. So, of course, her brother, Tony Rodham, who now is dead, of course, was placed on the board of one of Haiti's major mining corporations concerns inside of Haiti. The problem they have in Haiti is that foreigners can't actually own land, right, under the current Haitian constitution. And that's why, of course, you've seen this big push since Jovenel Moise to change and rewrite the Constitution. They want foreigners to be able to own Haitian land, even though today all they can do is buy the rights to the mineral wealth and work with local Haitian proxies in order to extract its wealth. But that's not quick enough for them. They want to be able to get in there and rape the land. And so we see this move to change the Constitution that the U.S. has supported, ostensibly to improve the election procedures. Well, the only thing that needs improvement in the election procedures in Haiti is that the United States get out of it and stop meddling, because they've intervened in the last three election cycles to preference candidates that they wanted, that they believed were proxies that were the best representatives of U.S. foreign policy. And that needs to stop.
That needs to stop, all right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Kevin Pina is senior producer for Flashpoints and knows as much about Haiti. He has spent a lot of time there documenting what's happening on the ground, U.S. role in the situation that has led to where it is now. And one of the things that we confronted together, Kevin, was the way in which the press was infiltrated, that they were, you remember that NPR was using the same reporters as Voice of America, and that I guess it was the National Endowment on Democracy was funding the people that the New York Times were using as their folks on the ground to gather information. You want to remind people, you know, and they had to, the AP had to actually have a public press conference and say, we were infiltrated, these people are not going to work for us anymore.
Well, you know, and it's still going on. All you got to do is just follow the direction of the narrative, and you can pretty much tell who's who's behind which type of reporting that you're seeing about Haiti. You know, I think the bigger point is that you really have to find a few trusted sources that have direct connections on the ground in Haiti that are reliable. And you've got to do your research. You've got to do your homework. It's very difficult in a very complex political terrain, but don't fall for the simple sloganeering of some people who may happen to say the right thing one day, but they are really on a different trajectory altogether when you look at them in a year or two. Right? I learned that early on. Some people really mouth the right things in the interim, but in the long term, you find them going in a completely different direction than where the people on the ground in Haiti are going. And, you know, it took me years of honing my political instincts and working with Haitians closely to be able to have some sense of where people are really coming from. This thing about, well, I'm Haitian. You know, and that's great. But I also known a lot of right-wing Haitians who got it wrong or who supported the wrong thing, who supported the coup. You know, I've also known a lot of Haitians who supported Duvalier. You know, that's no guarantee of political correctness or that you're provided more credibility. So you have to be discerning in the voices that you listen to. And I think a lot of people know when they hear something authentic versus when they hear something that's sloganeering or just coming out of left field in order to garner attention or to garner followers, you know? Longevity and consistency are really important. You got to look at those sources that have had consistency. And, you know, folks who are on this program, you know the people you've had on here, know the voices of the Haitians in particular, who've taken the lead in teaching us and helping us to understand the situation. You know, we put a lot of wonderful voices, Haitian voices, on this program, Dennis. And so I hope that in some small way, because I helped you to arrange those interviews, that in some small way, that will contribute to people being more discerning about the situation and who and what they're listening to as we go forward, because there's going to be a lot of conflicting, confusing information, and some of it is intentional. And it really requires being disciplined. And, you know, go back to the archives. Go back to the archives and look at the special reports that we've done on Haiti. Look at some of the voices like Franz Jerome, like Pierre Labossiere, you know, like Maude Jean-Pierre. You know, we've had some incredible people on this program. You know, we've had a couple politicians on the program too. You know, from Famille Lavalas and other parties. You know, we.
I'm blanking. Why am I blank? John Juste, who we interviewed in handcuffs as he was being arrested for giving out food.
Another time, we interviewed him when they were shooting at his church. I don't know if you remember that, breaking out the window.
Yes.
You know, so I think we've done our job as journalists to provide a different view from the people on the ground inside of Haiti to give people, if you go through the archives and look at the Haiti programs we've done, it'll help you. You'll get a better sense of what the reality is. And you know, we thank you. I thank you for giving it the attention that it deserves.
I guess you would say that people should not be sort of hoodwinked by the little whisk of a smile from Sean Penn, who, when you say the only thing people know about Haiti is Sean Penn went there and he's a good guy.
Well, you know, people use a lot of tactics and techniques and arguments to win, you know, the credibility game, if you want to call it that. And, you know, yes. They, like I said, you just got to be careful. They might be saying the right thing today, have no legs in Haiti or really not understand the situation. But today it's going to get them more followers. It's going to get them more attention. And you might fall prey to that. But in the long run, it's about consistency and it's about, you know, knowing the forces on the ground. And I think consistency is the most important thing. Look at whose politics have been consistent throughout this, whose analysis has been consistent. And I think that will guide people, you know, to the right sources.
Amazing. And speaking of the right sources, Kevin, how do people follow the incredible work you do and the way in which you put the information out?
Well, when I have my sort of personal insights and things that you know that affect me personally, I put it out on my personal Twitter account, which is @AcrossMediums. But generally, you'll see a lot of the work that I'm doing with Haitian citizen journalists on the ground coming out of @HaitiInfoProj, @HaitiInfoProj, on Twitter. Our website was attacked. It's down right now. There's an older version there. It's got all kinds of alerts on it. I'm working to try to fix that. Any of you technical experts out there in HTML want to give me a jingle or send me a line at, what is it? It's I think it's kpina@kpfa.org.
Yes,
I'd love
like
to
a,
get some assistance.
I hope you get that assistance, Kevin Pina. I'm sort of thinking about, I just remembered that didn't you have the phone number once for the CIA operative who was running the Haiti situation for the United States? Didn't we call him up
after
in his office?
After the first coup in 1991. It was Lynn Garrison, right?
He was the guy who
provided the evidence to Brian Littell and the CIA when they made the claims in front of the U.S. Senate that Aristide had been institutionalized in a Canadian mentalist institution, that he was on lithium.
A human rights violator. He burned
tire burning, necklacing, pelebrun, as it's called in Creole. Right. We called that guy directly in his office.
He was really wondering who we were, and we were wondering.
I think he knew exactly who we were.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well, that's Kevin Pina. He's the senior producer on the Flashpoint Show. He's amazing. His knowledge of Haiti is extraordinary, and it's always been over the last 20 or 30 years. I'm losing track. There when it matters.
30.
Thanks, Kevin. Be safe, and we'll talk to you soon, okay? All right.
My best to everyone. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Thank you. Kudos to Kevin Pina. We now turn our attention to Israel. Guess what? Bibi Netanyahu appears to be back. Well, Richard Silverstein writes on his blog, Tikkun Olam, latest exit polls show resounding victory for Netanyahu's far-right coalition. Anywhere from 61 to 62 seats, he will form the most extremist government in Israeli history. This means that the most violent allies will demand ministerial posts. They will be angling for security portfolios, which will enable them to catch it. Expand settlements, theft of Palestinian land, and use an iron fist in dealing with any unrest in Palestinian communities. This does not look good. Joining us is Richard Silverstein. He's back again, and despite the fact that aren't there multiple criminal investigations that he continues to face? What's the deal?
Well, yeah, he's got four corruption charges against him. I don't know what has happened to that case. The attorney general was supposed to prosecute it, and it looks like it bogged down. And now that Netanyahu is going to form the next government, he has enough votes to actually hollow out the law about corruption and to give him a walk on the charges. They're already talking about such legislation, and it just goes to the fact that this new government is going to destroy any vestiges of what used to be democracy, going to hollow out the media, the free press, and the judiciary is going to be extremely weakened, and the rule of law is gone. I mean, it's what I call a fascist state. This is the triumph of fascism.
You know, it's a mind blower. I just had to happen to catch a few minutes of Joy Reid, who had Hillary Clinton on, and they were talking about a bunch of different things. And then Joy Reid, who was sort of innocent, had been doing some research and saying, "God, this guy is sort of ugly. Oh, well, aren't we worried, Hillary Clinton, about Bibi Netanyahu? Doesn't he scare you?" And her response was, well, long pause. Well, he actually is a consummate politician. She said something like, he may be just the right person. We don't know. He has a lot of experience. You want to respond to that?
Being a consummate politician is actually a curse and not a blessing. What Bibi is a consummate tactician, which is different than being a consummate politician. In other words, he knows exactly what to do to stay in power. He knows who to manipulate. He knows who to buy off. He knows how to wend his way through and retain power. That's all he cares about. For you or for I, democracy is the consummate, you know, a value in a democratic society. For him, democracy is only a means to an end, and the end is personal power, and that's all he cares about. He will do anything necessary to maintain it, except, of course, being a dove or a liberal, but that's because Israeli society has turned far to the right, and he doesn't need to do that. But he's a chameleon. He has no principles. The only thing, you know, he believes in is himself.
I imagine the Kushners would be celebrating this new ascension to power. You're concerned about the kinds of folks he will choose. He has allied his party with. Can you talk a little bit about the folks he'll be surrounding himself with?
Well, there's a party called Jewish Power, which is modeled on Meir Kahana. It has never gotten more than a couple of seats in the Knesset, and this time it's doubled its representation and now has 14 seats out of 61. So it's a huge player in the new coalition. And by the way, the two leaders of this coalition are avowed Jewish terrorists. One, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is the leader of a terrorist movement, although he doesn't leave his fingerprints on any of the acts of terror that his followers engage in. And Bezalel Smotrich is the other leader, and he was actually stopped by the Shin Bet on his way to plant a bomb to protest against the Jewish evacuation from Gaza. So we have two avowed Jewish terrorists who are going to become probably ministers in the Israeli government. And the U.S. government is having apoplexy about this. But the truth is that we've let this happen. You know, we don't have any foreign policy in this country that deals with Israel the way it really is. We have this sort of rose-colored glasses view of a democratic, liberal state that, you know, our parents and our grandparents told us about and we kind of worshipped. But it's no longer anything like that, and it's become an avowed fascist state, and we have to decide, what are we going to do about that? Are we going to keep our heads on the ground? Or are we going to actually stand up and do something? And so far, the answer is no.
What is the status of, there are Palestinians in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament. Not a lot of them, and they're oftentimes treated to threats and various levels of discrimination. Is there any movement? Will they lose still again under this new coalition by Netanyahu? Will they lose power again? Will they?
Results for the Palestinian parties have been abysmal. They had 15 seats in the last election. They were running as a joint list with four parties, and they ran together, and they had this fantastic result. One of the four broke away and actually was part of the current government, which is a center-right government, and the three others remained. And in this election, they disintegrated into three separate units, and one of the units failed to even get into the Knesset, and that left them, instead of 15 seats, they now have four. So through their own dysfunction and through the crooked system of Israeli politics, they're basically left with almost no voice in the Knesset. So they were the second largest opposition party in the last Knesset, and now they're going to be just a tiny little splinter. And it's really, really terrible. But the one thing about this is, if there's a silver lining, you and I hate fascism wherever we see it. In Israel, it's an exception, because many of us think that fascism's triumph in Israel will expose the naked face of it to the rest of the world and will give Israel even less support, more ostracism, and hopefully lead to criminal investigations by the ICC, etc. So the hope is that Israel will be exposed for its crimes and eventually be called to account. It isn't going to happen this today or next month, but hopefully in the years to come.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Richard Silverstein. Richard Silverstein writes on security and other issues at Tikkun Olam and for lots of other organizations, journals, magazines, and so on and so forth. We are talking about the fact that it does seem that Bibi Netanyahu will be forming a new government. He is back. Yes, Bibi Netanyahu is back despite his criminal activities. Could you just take a moment? What kind of criminal activities has this man been accused of? Is this something serious or just sort of petty criminality?
Well, it's both. Bibi is extremely venal, and his wife is even more so. So some of the corruption is just involves the cases of white champagne she loves. Arnon Milchan, the Hollywood producer, was tasked with providing him with Cohiba cigars and her with white champagne, pink champagne, I'm sorry. And so that's the petty venality. But he's also charged with trying to make a deal with the head of one of the major Israeli newspapers, in which he would agree that his BB-sponsored newspaper would not put out an edition one day of the week, and it's the largest in Israel, in return for the other guy's newspaper being favorable to Bibi. So that's the kind of corruption
that
happened.
Journalism, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's hollowing out journalism, which is what Viktor Orban does, and all of the fascist governments in Europe and whatever. That's one of the prime things they want to do. But the other things that he did was, the Israeli Navy has purchased nuclear-armed submarines from Germany, Dolphin submarines. As part of this multi-billion-dollar purchase, Germany, or ThyssenKrupp, the manufacturer, paid huge millions of dollars of bribes to several people, among them Bibi Netanyahu's personal attorney. Now, where do you think that money ended up? Although Bibi doesn't have any fingerprints on any of the cash, you know, that's what the corruption charge is about. So there's all these four different, you know, levels of corruption that we're talking about.
Wow. All right, listen, we have a couple minutes left, and I can't, I have to ask you about Bibi's relationship with the Russians, with Putin. You would think that would make the United States a little, give the United States some serious, some problems.
Well, Bibi, what I call a bromance with Vladimir Putin, for the last 4 or 5 years. He's been to Moscow, you know, like it's his personal resort. He goes like twice a year at least, and he gets welcomed in the Kremlin and, you know, lots of pictures. And so they're buddy-buddy, and the reason for that is that they both have interests in Syria. So the Israelis' interest is in intercepting Iranian missiles that are going to Lebanon for Hezbollah. And there's hundreds and hundreds of air attacks on Syria by the Israeli armed forces. And Putin, as you know, has his own interests in Syria. He's been an ally of Assad. He's part of the repression of the civil war that happened over the last decade or two there. So Netanyahu wants to make sure the Russians don't interfere with the Israeli raids in Syria, and Putin also wants to cultivate this relationship with Israel. It's more or less kind of a one-sided relationship. Russia is much more powerful than Israel. But the Israeli government realizes, it's not just Netanyahu, but his rivals realize that they need Russia more than Russia needs them. And so they cultivated this intimate relationship. And because of that, Israel can't take a position in favor of Ukraine. It's refusing to give the very important missile defense weaponry that Israel's developed. It's refusing to give it to Ukraine. And that is to keep in the good graces of Putin.
And the United States have anything to say about that? I mean, United States is the number one funder of Israel, military and otherwise.
Right, and we have nothing to say about it, nothing at all whatsoever. Our ally in this dogfight is Ukraine, and maybe behind the scenes, U.S. is trying to exert pressure, but we're always obsequious when it comes to Israel. We never push Israel to do anything that it's not willing to do, and Israel is very stubborn and won't give in to any sort of pressure. But if we don't put any pressure on them, then there's not even any possibility that the Israelis would have to resist, and that seems like what our approach is.
You know, I just have a couple of minutes left. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the case, but have you been following? I know you've been following the case about Israel and spyware and all the kinds of stuff they create, but there's a major case in terms of the kidnapping of these 43 Mexican student teachers.
Sure, yeah.
And they were surveilled. The Mexican government was using the Israeli technology. And didn't Israel give exile to somebody who's implicated in the slaughter of those students?
Yeah, well, the Attorney General of Mexico, who bought this NSO Group software called Pegasus, or malware called Pegasus, I can't remember his name. I think it was Tomas Zenon or Zeron, something like that. When the new government in Mexico, Obrador, came into power, he canceled the contract. And he investigated the Attorney General for corruption and for poisoning the investigation of the murder of the 43 students. And the Attorney General skipped town. He went to Israel. He got refugee status in Israel. And many people think NSO Group arranged for this. And NSO Group, by the way, is not just an independent company. It is really a creature of the Israeli government and the Israeli national security state. NSO Group, its interests and the country's and nation's interests are interwoven with each other. So I'm sure that the Israeli government collaborated with NSO Group to bring this corrupt Mexican legal official to Israel. And Mexico is trying to extradite him from Israel. And guess what hasn't happened? The government has so far refused to extradite him.
Wow. So essentially, you got the Israeli government harboring someone who apparently participated in the mass murder of students in Mexico.
That's right.
And nothing, exactly. I guess, nothing from the United States on this as well. No protests.
Well, the only way we've responded is about NSO Group itself. we've put NSO Group on a blacklist because NSO Group, by the way, their technology has been used to spy on U.S. diplomats in foreign postings. And all of a sudden, we've got religion and we decided, well, NSO Group has gone too far. So they're on a blacklist, and it's really kind of destroyed their international business. But that doesn't mean that their technology isn't still out there and being used in nefarious ways, but it has damaged NSO Group.
Amazing. Listen, I really appreciate the good reporting, Richard Silverstein. I do recommend people check out Tikkun Olam and check out your latest writing on this and other stuff. If you care about the region, if you care what's going on in Israel, what's happening between Israel and Palestine, great place to check out for information. Thank you, Richard. Please stay safe. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Dennis. Take care.
All right, bye-bye. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Tomorrow, if all goes well, we're going to have live special coverage from the Mission District, the historic Mission District of San Francisco, Day of the Dead celebration. Miguel Gabriela Molina's got us all ready and hyped up, and I'm looking forward. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Pacifica Radio, the People's Radio Network. Stay tuned.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m. Next up is The Bike Show.
The pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around, round, and round, round the town with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around, round, and round, round the town with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around, round, and round, round the town with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. Shooting round.
Hello, and welcome to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and streaming on KBO.FM. All our shows are also available on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. I hope this fall day, a rainy day in Portland, finds you well and healthy. Thank you for being with us today. My name is Alon Rab, and I'm joined by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Good morning, Nedra. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
And you're in Atlanta, right?
I am in Atlanta. And it's the afternoon here. We're in the 2 o'clock hour.
And